This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, actor Christopher Eccleston, co-stars in a new British TV series called The A-Word that's just started on Sundance TV. Eccleston also co-stars in the HBO series The Leftovers as the Reverend Matt Jameson, and was in the films Let Him Have It, Shallow Grave, and Gone in 60 Seconds. He also played Doctor Who for one season. In The A-Word, Eccleston plays the grandfather of a 5-year-old boy who's been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder. The boy has a hard time processing what people say to him and doesn't connect emotionally. The diagnosis disrupts the plans and assumptions that have been made by the parents, their teenage daughter, and their extended family.
Is there a cure?
A cure is not a disease.
All right, I didn't mean cure. I'm not up with the jargon. I'm still getting used to not saying spastic and mongol.
Oh, my God.
And colon's still hanging in there, eh, Dad?
We don't even know if it's the right diagnosis.
Exactly. You might want to take a second opinion. You know, he talks, he laughs, he looks you in the eye, he smiles. How's he autistic? I don't understand.
Right, no one uses that word. Not in this house and not outside this house.
What if we want to explain?
If we label him now, it's over. I am not having the rest of the town judging him at 5 years old and that's it.
That's right, because the rest of the town hasn't realised that there might be something different. That's why I get so many party invitations.
I don't know anything about this, but don't we need to be honest? Isn't that the starting point?
You're right, you don't know anything about it.
Eccleston's character, the grandfather, lost his wife a year ago, is in the process of retiring, and also has a hard time connecting emotionally. Terry spoke with Eccleston last Monday.
Christopher Eccleston, welcome to Fresh Air. So, as you pointed out, your character in The A-Word is not very expressive.
That's right.
And and now he's learned that his grandson is on the autistic spectrum.
Yes.
Which he's kind of suspected, you know, he suspected something was wrong. And he's trying so hard to relate to the grandson, but he doesn't really know how, and they're not quite connecting. What's it like acting with a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old who's playing somebody with autism and, I may say, is doing a great job at it?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary challenge for that boy, and he's done a great job. It does take patience because his concentration levels and spans are not that of an adult and an adult trained actor. It's his first acting performance, and it is the great challenge for the production. You know, there will be takes that he does where he is too engaged. You know, he is too, for want of a better word, normal. So the directors invented certain phrases like go into your dream world, etc. And it was a learning experience.
Yeah, and as a character, you're trying to get the boy to engage, and yet this young actor has to not engage with you. So it must be really tricky for you when you're trying so hard to engage him, knowing that it's the young actor's job to just disconnect and
To
be
disconnect.
In another world, be
That's
in another
right.
wavelength.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Morris is making the classic mistake, which I actually made.
Morris is your character,
Yes, Morris is making the classic mistake, which I made with my father when he began to suffer from vascular dementia, of trying to bring my father, and Morris tries to bring the boy, into Morris's world, where in fact what you have to do is you have to go into their world and play it by their rules. And that is the journey for the entire family, dealing with the individual rather than dealing with the condition, because there is a very specific individual in there. But you know what Peter Bowker, who wrote the series, is so skillfully woven in, is that you could probably locate Morris somewhere on the spectrum. Morris definitely has a inability to understand the emotional impact on people of some of the things that he says and does. I think what Peter has done is he's suggested that the grandfather and the boy are linked. And indeed, throughout the whole series, what the writer is highlighting is whether people are autistic or not, communication is difficult for all of these people.
I think you put that all really well. My guest is Christopher Eccleston, and he co-stars in the new Sundance series, The A-Word, in which he plays the grandfather of a 5-year-old boy who was diagnosed on the autistic spectrum. In the HBO series, The Leftovers, he plays Reverend Matt Jameson. Mm-hmm. And this is a series that starts when there's some kind of event, when about 2% of the world's population just vanishes. And no one really knows whether this is this a religious event, like the rapture, or is this some kind of supernatural, inexplicable event? And so, you know, people are just unhinged, and like new religions are starting up because nobody believes in the old ones anymore. Other people are getting more committed to their older religions. You play a minister who believes that the Great Departure, as it's known, isn't an act of God because bad people, people who were, you know, people have done bad things, vanish. So if it was the rapture, only good people would have been lifted up to heaven. So you've been going around trying to like prove to people that people have disappeared. There's some bad people there.
So, and buried in that, of course, is his own ego. That, I mean, basically what he believes is if it would have been the rapture, he would have been taken because he believes himself to be such a faithful servant to the Lord.
Right, and he's become, he's tried to become more deeply committed to his faith and to hold on to his church.
Yes.
But he's a little unhinged.
Yeah.
A little unhinged too.
He initially goes through a great spiritual crisis, but then lights upon the idea that he is Job of the Bible and the chosen one, in that the Lord has chosen him to punish him in order to test his faith. So his reaction eventually, after a period of bitterness and anger and railing, is to restate his faith and re-entrench his faith. And yeah, he identifies very strongly with the Job of the Bible, who of course we know had great many wives, great riches, and was God's chosen one. And then Satan challenged the Lord and said, I can make him turn against you. So that has been a guiding idea for us throughout the series.
Well, there's a great Job scene, and you walked us right into it, so let's hear that scene. So your character, the Reverend Matt Jameson, has gone to a town that has been spared from the Great Departure. Nobody in this town vanished. And it's now considered a sacred, holy, safe space. And so he and his wife have managed to become residents there. And she's in a kind of vegetative state ever since the day of the departure. She's been neither here nor there. She's been physically on Earth with her eyes open during the day, but there's absolutely nothing that registers on her. So he has taken her in a car and a wheelchair to the doctor and had to leave this special town to do it. And on the way back, he and his wife are mugged. Their wristband, which is their ID to get back into town, is stolen from them. And so he's trying to get back into town with his wife, who's in a wheelchair, and he can't do it. And the only way he can do it is through this smuggler who says, for $500, I can smuggle you back into this town. He doesn't have the money. But your character sees a woman standing next to a Winnebago with a big cross on it. So he decides, being a reverend, he decides to approach her and ask her for help. She's played by Brett Butler. Her name, the character's name, is Sandy. Here's the scene. And my guest, who you'll hear in the scene, is Christopher Eccleston.
Sandy, I'm asking for your help. I'm calling upon your sense of community and charity. Mary and I need some money so that I can get
How much?
$500. I know that's an extraordinary amount of money, but I give you my word as a Christian, I will pay you back.
What denomination?
20s. Whatever you can.
No, you're a reverend. What denomination?
Episcopalian.
Why?
My father was a reverend. I was raised in the faith, but I welcome all beliefs into my church.
Where'd you go to seminary?
Berkeley Divinity.
Where's that?
Connecticut.
What's your favorite book of the Bible? You got a favorite book?
Job.
What's his wife's name?
She isn't named. And she speaks only once. Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die.
Wait right here.
Good thing I didn't say Lutheran.
That's my guest, Christopher Eccleston, in a scene
from
The Leftovers.
She's such a sensational actress.
Yeah, and later in this episode, to further punish herself in a Job-like way, you climb onto a rooftop and put yourself naked in a pillory.
On the top of a taco stand, yeah.
Yeah, just a kind of bizarre scene. But anyway, I know that you're agnostic or atheist. I'm not sure which way you identify.
You know, I'm no longer sure now. I'd certainly made great play a number of years ago about my atheism, and things have changed in my life. And I know I'm no longer so certain. So I guess I would have to say agnostic now.
Really? Can you talk about what's changed?
Children. I had children. I have two very beautiful and center of my life children, Albert and Esme. I lost my father. I watched him suffer through his dementia. I had my own crisis earlier in the year. Life has happened to me, I would say. Life.
Because I know you best from The Leftovers, when I hear your voice in my head until seeing the A word, I thought of you as having an American accent, which of course you don't. You're from the UK.
That's correct, yeah.
And now I'm hearing you on the A word, but is the accent you use on the A word the same way that you're speaking to us now?
Yes, yes. I come from Salford, which is right next door to Manchester, famous, among other things, for producing Albert Finney and Mike Lee. And so I have a Salford accent, which has been softened over the years because I moved to London, and Londoners tend to be very lazy about trying to understand thick accents. So myself and my Scottish and Liverpudlian friends slightly neutralised our accents. But yeah, that I'm speaking as I based that performance on my father. Morris is based really on my father, Ronald Joseph Eccleston.
And he worked in factories, right?
He did. He worked in an American factory.
In England.
In Trafford Park in Salford, the Colgate Palm Olive. They called it a soap works, but it did much more than soap, toothpaste, deodorant, etc., shampoo, washing up liquid. And that's where he met my mother. They met in Colgate Palmolive. My father came down in a lift on his forklift truck. The doors opened and there stood my mother. And my mother said she looked at him and thought, oh, he's a bit of all right, but I can tell he's moody. And
is that diagnosis?
Yeah, absolutely accurate. And I said to my mom, how did you know that he fancied you? How do you know that he was interested in you? And she said, well, he reversed into the lift after he'd done whatever he was supposed to do. And as the lift doors were closing, he never took his eyes off me. And I was surprised at how cinematic my mother's description of that was. Amazing.
You've mentioned during this interview that your father had dementia during the last 13 years or 14 years of his life, and it was diagnosed as vascular dementia. Is that something different from Alzheimer's?
Yes, I believe it is. I think it manifests itself. Alzheimer's, as I understand it, and my understanding is somewhat rudimentary. Alzheimer's, what you often find with people suffering from Alzheimer's is that the past becomes the present. The memories of the past become much stronger and the memories of the present much weaker. So hence, you will find them sometimes walking down a motorway, insisting that they do not live in the house that they are currently in, that their house is somewhere else. My father's vascular dementia was really about a profound erosion of short-term memory. We didn't have the level of confusion of past and present. He just lost his short-term memory. Basically, you forget who you are. So obviously, he would get lost. He would fly into paranoid rages. He threw myself, my two brothers out of the house because he didn't recognize us. And in his mind, he was protecting his wife, my mom. He was diagnosed in 2000. Once they diagnosed him, we realized suddenly the penny drops. You know, you go, oh, so when he was doing that in 1998, so he was really suffering from about 1997, and he died in late 2012. And for all but the last year of his life, my mum kept him at home. And the big issue around dementia is the carers, often family members, who do incredible. What my mother did for my father was incredible. And she said to me, she said, Chris, the worst day of my life was not when your dad died. It was when I put him in that home. But myself and my brothers had to insist, really, because it was going to kill her. The burden of care was going to kill her. Because she had to do absolutely everything for him, you know.
When things happened, like your father throwing you out of the house because he didn't recognize you, he didn't believe that you were his son,
mm-hmm.
How did you learn to deal with things like that? Because you can't logically convince him that you are his son. I mean, if he has dementia, well, logic isn't going to work. So what did you do? Well, how did you approach that?
You make mistakes. I took my mother and father again to Cornwall for a break. And I was sat with my father and we're doing a crossword, which myself and my father had done since a very young age. You know, it was one of our ways of expressing love for each other. It's something that we did. And I read out a clue. My dad was sat to my left and he was pretty far on with the dementia. And I read out a clue saying six letters, dictator. And quick as a flash, my dad said, despot. Quick as a flash. This is a man who could not really take himself to the toilet, to the bathroom. He said despot. And I thought, wow, you know, I would have said Hitler or Stalin, you know. This, you know, it's... So I looked at him and I said, "What? Nice one, pal." We always had this banter. I said, "Oh, I love that word, pal, nice one." And as I'm writing it down into the crossword, I felt him staring at me very fiercely. And he said to me, "Are you related to me?" And I looked at him and I said, "Yeah, I'm your son." And he said, "What? You're my son? Where'd you get that from?" I said, "Well, Dad, I'm Chris, I'm your son." And my dad became extremely agitated. And he went into the room and he said, "This bloke here," said to my mum, Elsie. He said, "Elsie, this bloke here, he's telling me that I'm his father. I don't know what he's talking about." Now, what was going on was my father thought I was suggesting that he had me out of wedlock. Therefore, that would be a threat to his relationship with my mother, his carer. Now, the great mistake I made there was that I tried to bring him back into my world for my own emotional needs. What I understood from that time, because it got very distressing because we were in a cottage by the sea and he was very, very agitated. He got very, very angry at my mother in the bedroom, because he felt she was going to turn against him because he'd had a child out of wedlock. I hope you're following this.
Yes.
But I, from that moment on, I understood that I cannot impose reality on my father. I cannot bring him into my world. I have to go into his. So I stopped calling him Dad. I would call him mate or pal. And if he thought I was a taxi driver, then I was a taxi driver. And I dropped all the expectation, and I became what he needed me to be, which was, you know, "Hello, pal, how are you?" You know, I'd say, "How are you doing, mate? You okay? How's Elsie?" You know, his mum, and I wouldn't say mum, I'd say, "How's Elsie? Is she all right?" "Yeah, she's fine. You know, you have to go into their world. There was a moment once, my mum, for instance, her needs. He was sat in his chair, my mother was on the sofa, and my mum said, "Ronnie, do you know who I am?" And he looked at her and he said, "Yeah, of course I do." She said, well, "Who am I?" And he looked at her and he said, "I don't know, but I love you." You know, things like that. And there was also a sweet spot with my father's illness, which was quite early on, perhaps not long after the diagnosis, when he still knew that myself, Alan and Keith were his sons, there was a sweet spot where this is a very, very working class male, you know. Went to work in heavy industry from the age of 14, very poor when he was growing up, tough man, not great at expressing his love physically or verbally. The three of us all had experiences where we went to visit them and he insisted on walking us up the path and back to our cars. And with me in particular, he said to me, he got me to the car and he said, hey, cock. And I turned around and he said to me, I love the bones of you, you know. Oh. Now, yeah, I love the bones of you. It's a very Salford expression. He would never have said that. But there was this sweet spot where what happens with dementia is their inhibitions are destroyed, you know. But there was a sweet spot where those inhibitions about being demonstratively loving, but what I've realised, because my dad was, though not very well educated, he was a very intelligent man and really missed his way. He was saying goodbye. Is what he was doing. He knew.
Well, Christopher Eccleston, I love your acting, and it's just been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much, and thank you for sharing so much of your life with us.
Thank you for giving me so much time.
Christopher Eccleston speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. Eccleston co-stars in the BBC series The A Word, which is now playing on Sundance TV. Eccleston also co-stars in the HBO series The Leftovers. Ben H. Winters is a writer whose work has spanned different genres. His 2012 book, The Last Policeman, won an Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers of America, and his 2013 book, Countdown City, won the Philip K. Dick Award for Distinguished Science Fiction. Winters' latest novel, Underground Airlines, mashes together elements of the thriller with speculative history. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, says that however you classify Underground Airlines, it's indisputably a winner. Here's her review.
One of the comforts of reading a work of so-called alternate or speculative history is being able to stop reading it. What I mean by that is, most novels that imagine the different ways the past could have played out imagine things going really, really wrong. Think, for instance, of Philip Roth's novel, The Plot Against America, in which Charles Lindbergh wins the 1940 election against Franklin Roosevelt and promptly signs a peace treaty with Germany and Japan. An even grimmer variant on World War II history is Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle, where Germany and Japan win the war and divvy up the United States between them. And at the more sci-fi-ish end of the spectrum is Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, in which a Christian terrorist group takes over the U.S., suspends all constitutional rights, and renders women completely subject to the rule of men. As ingenious as these novels are, it's also a relief to leave their worlds and hightail it back to the broken but nonetheless better real world that we readers live in. An extraordinary new novel of alternate history, however, refuses to deliver that payoff of relief at the end. Instead, Underground Airlines by Ben H. Winters jolts readers to a heightened awareness, making us see just how much of the nightmare of what could have been is part of the all-too-familiar reality of what is. Underground Airlines imagines that the Civil War never happened. Rather, Lincoln was assassinated before he took office, and in an act of compromise, some states were allowed to maintain slavery. Those slave states, known as the Hard Four, consist in the present day of Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and the reunited Carolinas. They're demarcated from the rest of the U.S. by heavily patrolled borders. the other states in the Union have agreed that any slave or person bound to labor, as they're called, must be returned to the corporate plantation from which they've escaped. That's where Victor, the anti-hero of this noirish novel, comes in. Victor is a bounty hunter working for the U.S. Marshals Service. He's adept at infiltrating abolitionist groups and retrieving runaways because he's black himself. Or rather, as Victor precisely tells us, he's moderate charcoal with brass highlights, which is one of the 172 varietals of African American skin tone delineated in the U.S. Marshals Service Field Guide. When the novel opens, Victor is sitting in a diner in Indianapolis with a Catholic priest who's suspected of running a rescue cell of what's called the Underground Airlines. Victor is posing as a husband, a free man, desperate to rescue his wife from enslavement in a strip mine in Western Carolina. That's all just a ruse, of course. The person Victor has been assigned to find is a runaway named Jackdaw, who's escaped to Indianapolis from a plantation in Alabama run by the Garments of the Greater South Corporation. Victor's voice, melancholy and wry, leads us through the labyrinthine hunt for Jackdaw, as well as through the puzzle of his own identity and why he's working as a bounty hunter in the first place. Let's just say that Jackdaw isn't the only fugitive here, on the run from the unbearable. Like all great works of suspense, and this is one suspenseful tale filled with double crosses and dangerous expeditions down drainage tunnels and into plantations, Underground Airlines is hyper-attentive to details. The world Winters conjures up is chillingly credible. It's a world, for instance, where the righteous pride themselves on eating food and buying clothes that have the so-called clean hands seal of approval, meaning they haven't been produced by slave labor. It's a world where persons bound to labor are branded at the base of their throat with the tattoos of their corporate owners. Anti-slavery activists voluntarily sport similar tattoos in solidarity. And it's a world where every city in the North has its freedman town. In Victor's description, a neighborhood of ramshackle houses and crumbling high-rises, crammed to the gills with the poorest of the poor, living hard, the forgotten children of forgotten children. In Underground Airlines, author Ben H. Winters has imagined not only a disturbing but plausible alternate reality for the United States, but as a white author, he's also imagined himself into the body and consciousness of his black narrator, Victor. These days in particular, that's a controversial move. But the exceptional novel that results seems to me to be justification enough for such an act of creative crossing.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Underground Airlines by Ben H. Winters. Our next guest, Jesse Klein, is the head writer of Comedy Central's Emmy Award-winning series Inside Amy Schumer. The sketch comedy show is written from a feminist perspective, and so is Klein's new collection of funny personal essays called You'll Grow Out of It. She writes about her experiences dating, getting engaged, getting married, giving birth, and finding her place in the comedy world. Before she started writing and doing stand-up, Jesse Klein worked at Comedy Central, first as a temp and later in development, finding and working with new talent in the late 90s and early 2000s. She's also written for Saturday Night Live and Transparent. She spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Jesse Klein, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from your new book. You want to start from the very beginning?
Sure. This is the chapter called Tom Man. Everyone is charmed by a little tomboy, a scrappy little girl in overalls with a ponytail and scraped knees who loves soccer and baseball and comic books and dirt. But what are we charmed by? It's not just that she's cute. It's that she so innocently thinks she's going to stay this way forever. But we all know she won't. And why is that? Because as much as we like a tomboy, nobody likes a tom man. You might be wondering, what is a tom man? I've never heard this term before. You're correct. That is because I invented it. It is the only thing I have ever invented. A tom man is what happens when a tomboy just never grows out of it. For as far back as I can remember, the voice in my head has sounded like the voice of a man. You might think the next thing I'm going to tell you has something to do with being gay or thinking I'm a man trapped in a woman's body, but neither is the case. What I mean is that literally, walking around as a child, the little voice I'd hear narrating my own thoughts and experiences sounded like Daniel Stern in The Wonder Years. I think this is because the very idea of possessing an inner voice felt by definition like a male characteristic. In contrast, the tent poles of femininity, as I observed them, high heels, eye makeup, Diet Coke, smiling, etc., all seemed to be focused on the external. In any case, they felt completely foreign to me. As a result, throughout my childhood, I felt like an outsider to being a straight girl, even though I was a straight girl.
That's Jessie Klein reading from her new book, You'll Grow Out of It. So what were some of the things that girls of your generation were doing that you didn't relate to?
Oh my gosh. I would say it started even just with Barbies. I never had any interest in Barbies at all. And then just going on the occasions that I went to any sleepovers, which I didn't do very often because I didn't have many friends. Just makeup, no interest. Skirts, no interest. Dresses, no interest. Diet Coke, no interest at the time. I would say just kind of the whole thing. I didn't relate to it, and I just didn't feel organically interested in any of it.
I love that you really wanted to have men find you very sexy, but you didn't want to wear the things that were supposed to be sexy, including sexy underwear, which you write about a lot. And you've come up, I must say, with the great phrase, the thong industrial complex. Thank you for that.
Thank you. And you're welcome.
So are there aspects of the whole sexy thing that struck you not only as wrong for you, but as absurd?
Yes. Again, kind of all of it. I mean, I was born in 1975, and I don't know when thongs were invented. I suppose I could have Wikipedia'd that before I got here. But it seems, you know, it's like they're along the way between then and now. It seems like a whole bunch of problems got invented. I don't feel like I remember women worrying as much about a panty line as they do now, like that should be such an eyesore, is to notice someone's underwear slightly underneath their clothes. Yeah, thongs are really like a big thorn for me. But I think also even like it wasn't kind of a law that you had to have a perfect manicure and pedicure all the time. It feels like that's something that kind of, I mean, I think my mother to this day has had maybe one manicure, and it's one that I forced her to have because I thought, oh, maybe this is an enjoyable experience for us to share. And she was like, what is this? Why are we doing this? I think so much of it is really absurd.
So you had this real crisis when you were getting married and you had to buy a bridal dress.
Oh.
And you never really liked that whole princess fantasy dress thing, but the whole bridal gown industry is kind of based on that.
Yeah.
And you nearly had a meltdown while you were shopping for your dress because you couldn't find something that fit you, that you also liked, that you felt comfortable in, and that you could afford. Just in terms of the argument you were having or the conversation you were having with yourself about how you should deal with a wedding dress, can you go over some of that conversation for us?
Yeah. I definitely started when we got engaged and were planning. I mean, at first we did City Hall, and then we thought, oh, well, it's something for your family, and let's have a real wedding, small wedding. And I'm like, right, well, I'm a cool feminist who doesn't really care about this stuff. I probably won't even wear a wedding dress at all. I was just very like, oh, I'm too cool for this. I'll wear jean shorts or a tube top. I don't care. And then I had some friends who were interested in taking me shopping. Like, that's a thing too, I guess. But I think once I put one toe in the water of like deciding I would wear a dress and then I would try one on, I got like hooked into the conflict of it. And it was sort of like a double wound. I think there's like this idea in Buddhism of like there's the thing that's hurting you, and then something, it's hurting you that it's hurting you, if that makes any sense. I could feel that I wanted to find a dress that I looked really pretty in. I could feel, you know, being someone who lives in a society where that is like a pressure that on your wedding day you're going to look perfect. I suddenly was like, oh, I'm susceptible. I actually do feel this. And then I was just so angry that I felt it. And that kind of led to a very schizophrenic series of conversations in sweaty dressing rooms by myself.
And you finally rejected the super expensive dress that you almost bought and bought something much cheaper, which you ended up taking off before the wedding party was over.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a flirtation with buying a $10,000 dress. Even saying it, I feel so embarrassed. It was, I was at the end of the search, which had taken months. I was running out of time. And I saw this little Valentino, like Audrey Hepburn-y dress. And I put it on, and I have to say it was beautiful and it looked amazing. And I hadn't looked at the price tag. And I was like, oh my God, I found it. I found it. And then I looked down and it was $10,000, which is very much out of the budget. And I had what I would describe to friends as like, oh, this is like what men think about when they're like pondering murdering their wives, is just like this bargaining of how it's going to go. I was just like, well, I won't tell anyone what it costs, and I'll buy it in cash, and there'll be no credit card trail, and I'll throw away the tags, and I'll say that it was from, you know, TJ Maxx or something. And I just had a real plan. And then I kind of looked in the mirror and I was like, oh God, what have I become? And I kind of ran out of there. It was absolutely not about the dress. It was my own crisis of identity. And I think this feeling of, this is me needing to look like a pretty lady woman for literally, what is it ultimately, 3 hours? And can I not even get this done for 3 hours? And at that point, it started to feel less like this choice that I've sometimes participated in of I don't want to be a girl that looks like that girl. And it became, oh, I'm really not even capable. Like, I just can't get it done at all. And I think that's what got me so agitated.
So how did you know Amy Schumer? And how did that lead to you writing for Inside Amy Schumer?
Amy and I met doing stand-up. I had been doing stand-up for a while, and one night we're at this show that I believe the first time we met, it was at a show that was run out of like a children's aid society, if that's still a thing, like a gym. And I watched her from the back of the room, and I'd never seen her before. She was definitely not famous. And I was just like, oh, this girl's so funny. And she specifically talked about, I remember she confessed that she had HPV in this very casual, thrown aside way. And it just like blew me away. And because I also have HPV, like many others. And I was like, I love that she just said that. And then we talked afterwards. I just adored her. And when she got her Comedy Central pilot, we would see each other around. And she texted me and was like, do you want to work on this pilot? And we went and had some drinks and got drunk. And that's what happened.
So I find it really interesting to have watched Inside Amy Schumer and then read your book and see some of the same issues dealt with in different ways. Like in your book, it's all like totally about you, totally personal. And on the show, even the things that are from your own experience are, you know, transformed into a comedy sketch. So In your book, you write about deciding to have a child after you got married. And then, you know, finally getting pregnant. And you have a whole chapter that's called, in capital letters, Get the Epidural.
And, please.
And, you know, it's all about how you didn't want to deal with the pain of it. You also wrote a sketch for Inside Amy Schumer called Better for the Baby, in which a small group of women are sitting around. They're all, like, very pregnant. And they're comparing notes about the totally perfect, natural, lovely childbirth that they're going to have. And it almost becomes a game of like one-upsmanship. Mm-hmm. So let's hear that sketch. And you wrote this, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's hear that sketch written by my guest, Jesse Klein. And Amy Schumer speaks first.
You guys?
Yeah.
I am so glad that we all got pregnant at the exact same time.
Yes.
Isn't that a treat?
Oh, have you guys figured out your birth plans?
Oh, yeah. For
all
months.
I know is I want a natural birth and definitely not an epidural.
Oh, my God.
I
mean, of course not. It's better for the baby.
It is better for the baby.
So much better for the baby.
Yeah.
We are having a water birth, but instead of water, we're going to fill the tub with gender-neutral barley, which is also the name of the baby it will be better for.
Oh, my little
cute
barley.
You see, love how that goes together.
My midwife said, suggested a sea turtle birth.
What is that?
Oh, it's when you give birth on a beach and you dig a small hole and you kick sand on the baby and you see if it crawls into the ocean or into your arms.
Wow.
It's better for the baby.
You know what? I would be careful, though, with a midwife. Even though they're not technically doctors, they still have some medical training.
And close enough.
I just don't trust Western medicine at this point. That's why I'm having my baby on the highest mountaintop in Tibet, as far from real medical help as is humanly possible.
Oh,
so smart.
My doula's a Sherpa.
Oh. My doula is a 3-month-old baby, so she, like, gets it.
Wow.
So beautiful.
Sounds authentic.
Well, I hope you all plan on eating the placenta.
Of course.
Yum, 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 yum,
yum.
Every
except
drop.
Except for the part that you bury in the front yard. Mm. It's so full of nutrients.
I'm just juicing it. It's better for the mother. Oh, no. And the baby. Mm. Oh, my God, you guys. I don't care about myself.
God.
Oh, my God.
That's an excerpt of the sketch Better for the Baby, written by my guest Jesse Klein, who's the head writer of Inside Amy Schumer and now has a collection of personal essays, funny essays called You'll Grow Out of It. So tell us how your experience transformed into that sketch.
It felt so foreign and crazy to me to be pregnant in the first place. I hadn't really anticipated that I would have a baby necessarily. It just always felt so surreal. But I did, in my contact with other pregnant women or women who had had kids, there did feel sometimes like this game of one-upmanship that would be happening around just how holistic and perfect a birth anyone could have. And there's this contest that, as I write in the book, a friend of mine at one point really helped me out because she said, what are you trying to win? And there really is nothing to win. And I hope more women who are pregnant or women who are not pregnant, because I think this also goes into other aspects of women's lives too. I think we often feel like we're in a contest of some kind, and the contest is generally kind of a bummer, and the prize is usually also an illusion and is false.
Well, related to childbirth, you have a story in your book about you finally get an Emmy for Inside Amy Schumer. Very exciting. You'd only recently given birth, and as everybody's going to the after parties to celebrate, you're in a room alone pumping.
Yeah.
Because you still have breast milk.
Yep.
And describe how
Try
you,
not to be jealous.
Describe how you emotionally felt in that moment. I mean, on the one hand, like, you're so lucky. Like, you have a husband you love. You'd given birth. The birth went well. You had a healthy baby. You were pumping. You just won an Emmy. Like, it doesn't get better than that. But how are you actually feeling?
I don't want to underplay how genuinely awesome and exciting it was to win an Emmy. And that was an incredible moment and was just thrilling. But yeah, then I did have to retreat as the show was ending. The producers had very nicely arranged for me to have a little dressing room that someone else had used and was done with. And I had my pump, and my friends and coworkers, you know, went on to the governor's ball, which is the big after party, and I said I would catch up with them when I was done pumping. And I'm sitting there with the Emmy statue at my feet, and I have to, you know, I'm wearing kind of a fancy dress, and I have to figure out how to unzip it on my own. And then I put on my nursing bra, and the pump makes this really kind of ridiculous, unpleasant, like, zhoot, zhoot, zhoot noise that's very loud. And as I'm sitting there, I felt a little lonely, and I had a lot going on in my own life at that point with exhaustion, and my baby was only 3 months old, and, you know, having a baby is really hard on a marriage. So things with my husband were just, I'll just say they were very hard, because we were just so tired and it's so crazy. And I just suddenly felt very much like, oh, I won this Emmy and tomorrow I'm getting on a plane and I'm going right back into my own little struggles and nothing is really different. Like, this was great, but now it is over and I just have to be back in my sort of currently overweight, milk-laden body and waking up at 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. and it's hard. And the Emmy is amazing, but all of this will continue. I think it just brought into very stark relief in the moment what would have been the truth no matter what I was doing, but it was very immediate, which is that this doesn't really mean anything for your actual happiness or your life.
Well, Jesse Klein, thank you so much for talking with us. I think you're really funny, and I wish you good luck on all the things that you do.
Oh, thank you so much. It was so, so fun to be on. Thank you.
Jesse Klein spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Her new collection of essays is titled You'll Grow Out of It. She's head writer of the sketch comedy series Inside Amy Schumer. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.